Talk given Sunday, 19th November, 1972. You may recollect that last time we took a brief survey of the different race groups which came into India from about 70 centuries ago, settled down there, and built up, step by step, what we are accustomed now to call Indian civilization. First, the Negritos and Proto-Australoids, who established village settlements from something like 70 centuries ago, followed about 2,000 years later by Sumerians and Armenians particularly, and others from the Euphrates-Tigris region, who established the Indus Valley civilization with an extraordinarily high degree of culture, and then later on, about 1,500 years after them, there come the Aryan-speaking peoples bringing the Rig Veda with them. And of course, the Brahmanism and Hinduism, which developed ultimately out of the interaction of all these different races, was one in which the idea of the gods, the angelic orders, the demonic orders, and so forth, all played their part. We must look a little bit at this particular situation in which the human race has always been placed. As far as one may conjecture, as well as know from historical fact, one sees that the idea of spirits, of gods, of powers other than human, superhuman both ways, in the direction of the good and the beneficent, and also in the direction of the evil and the maleficent, has played a very important part in the religious life of the whole of the human race. It was impossible for man to escape the sense of something other than himself. That which he saw and heard and touched and tasted and felt bodily was not everything. All kinds of things he sensed, if for no other reason, at least from his dreams. He must have been very perplexed in certain ways. For instance, he slew his enemies in battle. Sometimes he dreamt of them again. And you know how it is in a dream. Things are confused, things are very strange. You know, when you are afraid of something in a dream, you are running away from a lion, one of the ordinary dreams when many people dream. And you find that you can't run, although you did your 100-yard sprint inside the 10-second limit on earth, but you can't do it in a dream. Now, in dreams, these people must sometimes have come across their slain enemies, and they must have experienced this terrifying experience of being unable to overcome the enemy. In fact, he might have got the better of oneself in the dream, and he woke up in a sweat and wondered, "Good heavens, I thought I had killed my enemy. In fact, I buried him myself. What's happened? Does he exist in some form, some mysterious form, where I can't tackle him and that he can get the better of me? And what will happen then when I am dead and perhaps come across him? I'm just giving a trivial and a very simple instance of the kind of experience that man goes through psychically. All this is in the mind, as we know. See, all this is in the mind. Very good. So perhaps through the tens of thousands of years, this idea of spirits and powers got ingrained in the psyche, in the mind of man. Man must have inquired, what is this extraordinary phenomenon of the storm, the lightning, the thunder, earthquake? Then all the other aspect of it, the beauty and the marvel, the peace, the lovely calm days and the brilliant starlit nights and the charm of sun and moon and all the rest of it. What was it all about? And perhaps he felt that they are animated by some sort of spirit or other. When the spirit of the winds and the waves gets angry, lo and behold, those spirits exert their strength against us. They become maleficent to us. So, from his own experience in connection with his fellow beings of placating wrath, he must have felt, let's do something to placate these spirits, and so forth. So you see, in some way or other, or rather, in many ways, this idea of that which exists beyond what the senses convey to us must have emerged and become firmly fixed in the mind of man. So we must recognize this factor. And as man developed and began to get control over matter as well as over himself, and particularly as man began to develop intellectually inside himself, he must have begun to think in terms of some sort of overriding power or powers because of whose activity there was this cosmos. Because man must have noticed, oh, possibly hundreds of thousands of years ago, possibly hundreds of thousands of years ago, the regularity of the seasons and the way that plant life observed a certain cycle, a rhythm, and all the rest of it, human life ditto, and so forth. So that the idea of some order, and he couldn't imagine order without some controlling influence, some sort of order and some sort of power underlying that order controlled everything. So you see, this idea of that which is other than what the senses convey is something which man couldn't avoid. And in order to satisfy his mind as to what was this power and or powers, his ideas regarding spirits and gods and all the rest of it emerged gradually. Now let us look at the point at which an extraordinary, a radical change takes place in his vision and understanding of things. Not too long ago, maybe about 8-10,000 years, maybe a little more, but not too long ago, there were those who discovered that with the pacification of the sense functions, with the stilling of discursive thought, one entered into a state of quietness, of peace within oneself, and experienced an extraordinary rapport with the world, with life. Some may have gone very much deeper and experienced this very extraordinary thing, the complete cessation of all sense and discursive mind disturbance, and yet found themselves fully awake and aware of the world in which they lived in a totally different way. The outstanding feature of this total difference lies in the fact that it completely defies all expression in thought and in imagination, and therefore also in speech. It cannot be told. It was a state of ineffable bliss. Something extraordinary had happened. And those who had such experience knew that this is of the nature of the holy. It is of the nature of the transcendent. Take this to its supreme fulfillment known to us human beings until our own times. The perfected holy ones who enter into the state of complete communion, which is the state where all separative self-consciousness has ceased to obtrude upon the wide awake awareness of transcendence and the wholeness of the totality of the universe. Now, in that state of complete peace and quiet, there is no description of anything. There is activity which is not a disturbance. There is activity in which one is oneself is a wholly integral part of that activity. One is no longer conscious of being separate from it. But in this state, which in Sanskrit we call samadhi, which the Christian mystics and others call the unio mystica and so forth, in this state, having realized this holiness, this fullness, when one returns back to ordinary consciousness, because the return must of necessity take place because of the demands of the bodily life, food and activity and the natural functions of the body and so forth, all those have to be carried on. When the return takes place, what happens to that unified consciousness in samadhi? It once again becomes differentiated, where formerly there was no differentiation. Now, in the process of this differentiation, depending upon the intellectual development, particularly, the mental development of the person concerned, the awareness of this unitary transcendent energy, which we call pure mind or whatever you like, you see, the power of God or whatever you like, you see. This transcendent energy, which was a unitary experience, begins to split up into several main energies, each of which stands for something which is characteristic of the whole race of man, not only of the particular individual. Man has rulership in him. Man has graciousness in him. Man has love in him. He has mercy. He has stern judgment. And so forth and so forth. And these were the sort of main forms, these and several others, main forms in which that transcendent energy was split up by the mind. Because as you come back to ordinary, everyday sense and discursive mind consciousness, the analytical process once again plays a dominant part, and that process wherein there is only the integrated wholeness has subsided. Now, the Holy Ones, noticing this, that this transcendent mind energy functions through the human race in certain main ways, denominated those ways as the gods. They are the gods. Looking at life very deeply, very closely, they also noticed many ramifications of each of these main ways. They also noticed that there were all those energies which were constructive in nature and those which were destructive in nature. Or if you like to use biological terms, those which were anabolic and those which were catabolic. These were the angels and the demons and so forth. And they nominated them in this way because in those very early days, they had no means of expressing what they sensed in any other form. These were the days long before even speculative philosophy, before the logical intellect began to be very, very active. And therefore, they could nominate them only in anthropomorphic terms, just as men were rulers, men were workers, men were judges or town clerks or whatever they were, so too in the celestial sphere, all these powers and forces made up a hierarchy similar to that which prevailed in human societies. See, once we try to understand in our way, analytically, that which is transcendent to us, we think back analogically from what we are and we do and plant it upon that which is transcendent. This is not to suggest for a moment that that is the truth of the matter. The truth we don't know. We just don't know the truth. But this is how it appears to us. And this is an extremely important point to bear in mind. There comes the point in one's religious development through meditation and all the ways in which one enters the deep states of consciousness. There comes the point when one knows that all the gods, all conceptions, ideas, beliefs, theologies, systems that we might build up out of our image-making faculty, the imaginative faculty, out of the mind of man they arise and back into the mind they sink. Because man in samadhi has gone beyond the image-making activity of mind. We only make images. The whole host of gods and archangels and angels and the demons and the devils and the whole lot of them are created by you, by me. Now this produces a radical difference. When we see this, we see a radical difference between this and the popularly accepted idea that there is absolutely a spiritual world and a spiritual hierarchy which is the source out of which all this world and the world process has come into being. Now this is an error. The spiritual world, whatever its truth may be, which we don't know, but as postulated by us, is our creation. It comes out of our brains and our imagination. It doesn't exist apart from ourselves. So whatsoever we say about it, as if it were a wonderful working machinery in this transcendentally subtle sphere called the spiritual world, is a false statement. All the religious philosophies and theologies of the world which postulate these hierarchical orders and so forth and talk about them as if the angels were actual beings flying about and so forth, we are all talking falsely. We are only talking, in fact, of the pictures in our minds. Now this is not to suggest, not for a moment is this to suggest that there isn't reality. There is this transcendent reality. There is this energy which completely defies our thinking, our perceiving and expressing in words. But what that reality is, we don't know. The effect of that energy upon us is such that when we function in the ordinary way with our sense and discursive mind consciousness, we express in our terms. That is all. You take your pet cat or your dog. Can we just imagine for a moment how that cat regards us? If it does regard us at all, is it not likely that we are merely super cats to the cat, or super dogs to the dog, or super horses to the horse? You remember that lovely poem by Rupert Brooke on this matter? Read it. It's very, very interesting. Deliciously, subtly humorous too. But God for the tortoise is a super tortoise. For the fish, God is a super fish swimming in celestial seas and whatnot and whatnot. You see? And we humans, we do the same in actual fact. You see, that which is of a much less developed order of creation is aware of that which is a much more highly developed order of creation as transcendent to itself. We experience this extraordinary something which we call God, the Supreme, the Absolute, transcendent mind or anything. It is transcendent to us. But when we start talking about it, we only talk about it as we can only talk about it in our human terms. Now, so long as we recognize that fact, that this is how we talk about things, and realize that whatever we say, therefore, is merely a picture of the reality, we will not be so foolish as to think that what we have said is the truth. if we are saved from that folly, that is the end of all wars and conflicts, etc., in the name of truth or religion or anything you like. Obviously, we know we are just talking. He likes to talk this way, he likes to talk that way. This is according to his experience, this is according to his experience. But if we both know that what we are talking about is just talking, making pictures, amusing ourselves, trying to be happy about it, but the reality is beyond us, then we in our lives will be able to have true reverence, true worship, true awe, and a true sense of intimate relationship with transcendence without spoiling it with our pictures. After all, you are completely in love. Do you want to spend the rest of your life with the picture of the beloved or the actual beloved? Take your choice. It's just like that. But if oneself is so deficient in the top story as to be unable to distinguish between the picture and the real beloved, well, it'll be a marvelous tragicomedy which one lives in. Isn't that so? Now we must be very sensible about these things and see all this. But having seen this, then examine the gods and the angelic orders and so forth as presented in the religions of the world. Because those who presented all this were perfected holy ones as the originators. And the outstanding difference in their presentation, and a presentation which could have been made by a natural-born poet or an imaginative person, is just this: that those perfected holy ones knew the meaning of the perfected psyche, the utterly purified soul. Their psychology was the psychology of the mind which was perfect, devoid of all ill, of all evil. And they also knew the psychology of the man in sorrow, in difficulty, in confusion, in the imperfect, unvirtuous state. They knew everything about man's soul. And in terms of these mythologies and so forth which exist in the world, all of them, the whole lot of them, you have the essence of wisdom as far as the understanding of the human soul is concerned and the ways of the mind and the heart. I suppose all of you are far better acquainted, for instance, with Greek mythology than with the Indian formulations. You don't know the Puranas, do you? Perhaps some of you have not even heard of the Puranas. But in the Puranas and in the various mythologies of the East, Asia has presented what is presented in the Greek, the Scandinavian, the Teutonic, Celtic, and other mythologies. Here we have the essence of wisdom as regards the ways of the soul. I think when Rome established its supremacy by force, I'm talking of the Church of Rome, established its supremacy by force and discarded throughout all the mythologies as pagan, heathen nonsense or something. The Western world lost something of great value. The mythologies were studied only by classical scholars. They had learned Latin and Greek, particularly Greek, and therefore they read all these mythologies and treated them as just fanciful presentations, not of any special value. This was a grave mistake. They said, oh, look at all these gods and goddesses of the different mythologies. Good heavens, we have a superior morality to theirs and so forth. We wouldn't dream of behaving in all that sort of way. The actual fact of the matter is that the people of the world do behave in that sort of way, and much worse. That is the fact of the matter. And these stories of the gods and the goddesses and all the rest of it, put in a supremely instructive form, what happens to you and to me in our lives if we act in that way. And it also gives indications of the divine possibilities that open up before us. Take one example. Zeus, the lord of Olympus, begets Heracles by a mortal, Alcmene. Heracles is a man-god, therefore. His father is the immortal god, the lord of Olympus himself. His mother is a mortal. Now look at the labors of Hercules, of Heracles, the labors which he performs. If you look carefully through those 12 labors, you will see that they mark some of the outstanding stages in our spiritual development, in our religious unfoldment. Take, for instance, the cleaning out of the Augean stables. How does Heracles clean them out? And what precisely are the Augean stables? Let me look into my own soul. What do I find? Passions, lusts, whims, fancies, beliefs, convictions, conceptions, conflicts, confusions, kindness, generosity, good and bad, all alike in the most extraordinary conflict, a seething cauldron, so to say. Isn't this an Augean stable needing cleansing? And can I, a mortal, with my mortal vision and understanding and my mortal capacities, which are so limited, clean out this terrific stable? Oh no. But what does Heracles do? He just turns the course of a river. And the river, and remember, water, the waters of life, you just sweep through that stable, and the stable is cleansed. Now you see the lesson for us there. What an extraordinary lesson that is. And this is only one example out of literally hundreds of examples which one can give out of the mythologies of the world. They tell us the story of the progress of our own soul in its religious unfoldment. And he's a man-god. It's no use. There is no sense in despising the myth, the gods playing about with mortal women business. Nothing at all. There is profound wisdom hidden in it all. So we must understand all this. If we really appreciate this point, then we will see what the hymns of the Rig Veda really stand for. The peculiarity of the gods of the Rig Veda is just this, that in their case, there is nothing which is reproachable. They are always above board, very perfect, Victorianly virtuous gentlemen and ladies, the gods and goddesses of the Rig Veda. It's a peculiarity about that presentation. But once you're out of the realm of the gods and goddesses of the Rig Veda, and you go into all the different angelic and demonic orders of the Brahmanical and Hindu systems, you find the exact correspondence of all the other mythologies of the world. And they are all very, very instructive. Now, understanding that, let us see what we can learn with respect to the gods. Let me just read this little paragraph. The Vedas are essentially the expressions of the transformations of mind and consciousness experienced in the living process of the fruition of holiness, starting with the first metanoia, the lovely dawn vision of holy living, represented by the goddess Ushas, the goddess of the dawn, Eos of the Greeks. Eos, I should pronounce it, of the Greeks. Onward through the upholding of righteousness, Varuna. And the Rig Vedic god Varuna corresponds to the Greek Uranos. The triumph of spiritual victory, Indra. The utter purification of the soul by the Lord of Fire, Agni. You know the Latin word ignis, means fire. The inspirational flight of the alone, that is the Holy One in meditation, to the supreme alone, the absolute all, in supreme communion represented by the god Soma. Soma is the god of inspiration. Mind you, these gods are not beings outside yourself. It is you yourself undergoing these experiences, represented as an immortal god. Why an immortal god? I may go through this experience, but I will die. But the experiencing is something which is the common property of mankind through the ages. So it is immortal relatively to me, the mortal. Hence the immortal gods. And finally, the blazing forth of the light of realized transcendence represented by Aditya, the sun in the unclouded heavens. The name Aditya is very significant. The comparison is with the physical sun in the unclouded heavens. But Aditya, the name means born of Diti. Diti is the infinite, the illimitable. She is the goddess who is the mother of all the gods, the infinite unknown. You see what extraordinary wisdom actually is embodied in all this. So, the sun in the unclouded heavens. Let us look at another aspect of the Rig Vedic presentation of the gods. The whole of the celestial family is conceived after the pattern of the human family. And where the celestial family is concerned, there are no quarrels between the members of the families, of the family. They are always in perfect cooperation with each other. There is perfect division of labor. There is no exclusiveness. One god can take over the duties of another. Several gods may be concerned with the same activity. And each one also has his own speciality and so forth. And let us look then at the first one, Varuna, who is the moral governor of the universe, as presented in the Rig Veda, and who actually represents transcendent virtue, absolute virtue. Virtue understood not merely in a qualitative sense, and certainly not in the sense of just the opposite of vice, not in the relative sphere. But virtue, this absolute power which is the strength of the soul, and it expresses itself as transcendent love, wisdom, goodness and so forth in our lives. When we realize this sort of state, where we are completely purified and no longer resist transcendence, then our whole life displays transcendent love, beauty, wisdom and all the rest of it. And Varuna typifies that virtue. He represents that transcendent reality. There are all lots of hymns to Varuna, dozens of them, and I'm just going to read you a line or two. Varuna, king of hallowed might, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. Its rays, whose root is high above, stream downward. Deep may they sink within us and be hidden. King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. Where no way was, he made him set his footstep and warned afar whatever afflicts the spirit. 100 balms are thine, O King, 1,000. Deep and wide-reaching also be thy favours. Far from us, far away drive thou destruction. Put from us even the sin we have committed. Now, of course, that last verse one may ordinarily understand. Well, what about this middle verse? King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun, wherein to travel. And particularly, what does the first verse mean? King of hallowed might sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. What is this mysterious tree in the baseless region? It is when we come to this sort of thing that we have been misled by scholarship. Scholarship has approached the Rig Veda as a naturalistic polytheism, and it has tried to relate everything in the Rig Veda to the phenomena of nature and so forth, regarding the composers of the hymns of the Rig Veda as a primitive folk groping after spiritual reality. Now don't forget that as far back as in the Indus Valley civilization, 5,000 years ago, one of the things that has come down to us is a seal with the figure of Shiva in the pose of meditation. Now, if the god Shiva is in the pose of meditation, what does it signify with respect to the spiritual and religious life of the people of those days? They knew what meditation meant. And if the idea of Shiva, as it has been taken over finally into Hinduism itself, is the idea of the dual idea of the Lord of ascetics. He is the supreme ascetic, and also he is the Lord of reproductive nature. You will see that these were no primitive people groping after spiritual reality. Meditation, there's your key to it. What happens in meditation? How do you sit in meditation? You sit upright. What is this tree? The famous Aswattha tree of the Gita. The Yggdrasil of the Scandinavians. This tree of life and also the tree of good and evil of Genesis. This tree is no other than your own brain and nerves, the nervous system, the spine. And notice the extraordinary thing about it. The brain is the root. And the roots are above. And as we would commonly say, the branches are below and downwards. Man is the upside-down tree. Our roots point to the infinite, to the zenith, to the sky. The roots of a tree point downward into the earth, towards the center of the earth. And there is an end there. At the center of the earth, well, that is the center, and there is no further movement from there. But this way, it is endless. Now, King Varuna, and remember, Varuna represents virtue, absolute virtue, transcendent virtue. Therefore, he is called King of Hallowed Might, sacred strength, the pure strength of the soul, of the mind of man, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. Sustaineth erect, upside down, remember. This is the baseless, there is no base here. If the root was on the earth, well, there is a base for it. There is no base here. And if you want to talk of a base, it is the infinite, the absolute, the totality. You see, the extraordinary things that just those two lines represent. What man is, what his potentialities are. Where his origin is, where his source is, and what is trying to evolve out of him. But of course, one must have the key to unlock the secret of this. And the key is to know that the tree referred to is this tree, the brain and spine and the nervous system. This is the tree. Now look at the extraordinary significance of this. It is virtue which sustains this tree erect. This thing of sacred might, of sacred power, sustains it erect, upright. Well, think of the Buddha's teaching, the silas, the moralities, are the indispensable basis for any sort of religious unfoldment. Way back in the Rig Veda, this sort of thing goes back 15 to 20 centuries before the birth of the Buddha. You see? And then its rays, doesn't say its branches, its rays. It's a transcendent power, it's a transcendent something, which sends out rays, streams of energy, of power, whose root is high above, stream downward, deep may they sink within us and be hidden, be contained within us. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. Did the holy ones teach contrary things? No. They all taught the one great truth in wonderfully different forms. And we poor mortals have considerably gone astray. King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. A spacious pathway. We know the statement, straight and narrow is the way. That is perfectly true from our limited point of view when approaching transcendence. Look at it from the point of view of transcendence itself. The pathway for the sun, and remember the sun represents the fully enlightened consciousness. The sun shining in the unclouded heavens represents the fully enlightened consciousness. The pathway from the transcendent point of view is not a path. It is infinity itself. Anything, everything is of the transcendent, in the transcendent. And there it is for us. So that enlightenment can emerge in a million different ways. And it is Varuna, absolute virtue, who holds this tree erect.